The Spiritual Warrior, Talk 42, by Asha Praver, July 17, 2012. Copyright 2012, Ananda Church of Self-Realization, Palo Alto.
Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your infinite presence, that everything we do may be an expression of your divine presence within. Om, peace. Amen. Listen to my soul song, listen to my heart song, listen to my soul song, listen to my heart song. In secret in my soul, I will gather blossoms for thee, dipping them in dim ocean, I will lay them at thy feet. I will lay them at thy feet. Listen to my soul song, listen to my heart song, listen to my soul song, listen to my heart song. In secret in my soul, I will gather blossoms for thee, dipping them in devotion. I Great souls. Last week I talked a lot about celibacy and sexuality, and I kind of think we did that, unless anybody has questions or thoughts about it. There is, however, a lot of really wonderful information in this, in the notes, just about specific advice that Master gives about how to keep your life force under control. Which maybe I'll just talk a little bit about that. Master really warns, if you want to keep your life force under control, against unwholesome environments. And we have to, we live in an unwholesome environment. The whole world we live in is very unwholesome, except for our little bubble of it. He talks about overeating, lack of good personal hygiene, and entertaining unwholesome suggestions. I love that one. Be careful what you read. But then he also emphasizes lack of exercise. He makes a strong point about that when energy starts moving toward sexuality, that energy is just trying to spend itself, and you can direct it toward building a strong physical body. And if you're building a strong physical body, it's a way of redirecting that energy, because the life force is then being directed toward a constructive activity. So he really emphasizes, in addition to the energization exercises, I remember at one point, Swamiji had a dream about a bunch of football players. And they talked to him about the importance of physical exercise. and Swami commented that the brain, too, is a muscle. And when we don't exercise the whole body, the brain also atrophies. And that it's important just to keep everything exercised. And Master was really quite a sportsman in his younger days. And actually, so was Swamiji. Swami sets the example for almost everything for us. But we have an example of him living a very sedentary life for almost the whole time we've known him, except for energization. We still have him until very recently, being extremely physically strong, even though all he ever did was the energization exercises. But that was because he developed arthritis in his hips almost as soon as he started building Ananda. So prior to that time, he was quite active. He used to ski a lot. I even remember, this was very early, I remember going skiing with him once. And because he used to be an avid skier, but on that trip, he fell. And it was so difficult for him because of the arthritis that had already started in his hips that he didn't go skiing after that. But I believe he used to also play tennis. And he would have kept up with all those things because Master encouraged him to be physically active, but he wasn't able to be. So we have an example. It's just interesting. Otherwise, he would have also, I'm sure, set that example for us, but he wasn't able to. And even then, you know, in the early years, sometimes he would get in the swimming pool and play the wrestling games with the other young men, you know, one man on another man's shoulders and trying to pull each other off. You don't really think of Swamiji in such a context, but he even did that a few times. Yeah?
He also was quite good at the yoga postures.
Of course, he was very good at yoga postures, too. So I emphasize that because we don't want to lose sight of that. Plus, in terms of both breath control, mind control, and energy control, physical vitality, physical well-being is really important. In the lessons for marriage, the only even slightly oblique reference he makes to physical attractiveness or sexuality at all, it's not completely the only reference, but he says you should not weigh more than 10 pounds over the day that you got married. Which I thought it was just interesting. You know, it was a way of saying keep yourself physically fit and attractive. He talks also about how a woman should always dress nicely for her husband and things like that as a gesture of respect. But what he's saying is don't let yourself go. And then he also talks about the effect of food. And Gandhi, of course, talked a great deal about diet in the effort for self-controlling the life force. And he said, you know, diet, what you eat is separate from how much you eat. And he emphasizes both points. And again, it's also that thought getting in your mind of desires are there to be fulfilled and that you have to always be, because it's all one force. I mean, there's the other side of it is you have to give yourself a little slack somewhere. But nonetheless, we always laugh that food is the last legitimate pleasure allowed to the yogi. So that's where our meals, that's why Ananda is always so well known for making at least good food, but healthy. And then he just simply says, idleness. An idle mind is, you know, is inhabited by the devil. If you give yourself too much time off, people often think they need time off, but you really have to ask yourself how well you use that time. And it's a very important point because people are often really protective of their private time. But I remember this happened to this woman. She got married and had a difficult time coping with being married because she'd been in the habit of going into a very tamasic state when she was by herself. And all of a sudden, there was someone else in the house, and she wasn't able to just sort of become as much of a sloth as she had been in the habit of being. And she had controlled her life force by sinking into a really subconscious state. I didn't mean her sexual life force, but just her life force in general. She kept her equilibrium by going tamasic, which is that great challenge that all yogis have to face, which is to develop an aversion to tamasic energy. I've said this many times before, but you know, I've never seen anything like the way Swami Kriyananda keeps his consciousness high. Dharmadas put it in an interesting way once. He said, Swami never stops concentrating. So whatever he's doing, he's fully concentrated with his full energy on it. Whereas a lot of us, and I'll put myself in that camp too, just look for a place where we just could not. It's true. I mean, Swamiji will watch movies. He watches videos. He enjoys a movie. He enjoys relaxing. He used to read P.G. Woodhouse. But still, there's a refined quality to it, which is just notable. But above all, idleness. If you find that when you take your own time, that your mind actually spins in directions you don't want to go, then don't think that you should just keep having that time. You need to, the way I always think about it is, I've always thought of my good karma and my bad karma being like two race cars that are right next to each other. You know how the kids used to gun their motors at the stoplights and the drag racing, that's the word for it, where they'd shoot out and see who could get ahead. I always think my bad and good karma are just neck and neck like this. And I can't just sort of let off on putting out the good energy for fear the bad energy will take over until I'm really sure that I've just outpaced it a great distance. So it's always a good idea to have in reserve something that you're going to do. And maybe you don't have to always be out and about, but don't just sit there and think that you're being spiritual. Make sure that your energy is always in an upward moving direction, and if it's not, then activate it. It's better to be active all the time in an upward moving way than it is to allow yourself to sink down into moods, into unwholesome thoughts, all of the things that can happen to you. And we're talking about life control in terms of sexuality, but unwholesome thoughts are all kinds of thoughts. Mood, sadness, self-concern, worry, all of those different things. You know, just find, you know, knit socks for homeless people. Do something. I often... Your scarves are easier. Listen to Swami Kriyananda's classes in knit socks for homeless people. You just do something. I often have had hand projects. Like, well, this is, I'm talking more about seclusion. When I'm in seclusion and I want to be indoors and I want to be relatively inactive, I will often bring a hand sewing project. Because then I can listen to uplifting music or listen to Swami talk when I can't do anything more dynamic than that. But it's just enough to just keep me really... And then I usually find as seclusion progresses that I need it less. But it's a very good way to think about it. Okay. Master also warns us that we need to have our physical bodies working well. He speaks, and he often speaks, of the need for proper elimination. I mean, it's not a joke that if the body is filled with toxins, the mind is pulled down, and you cannot have control over the life force in any way because it's trapped in the body. Master said, many people, the phrase they used was, have a rattlesnake in their intestines, meaning that they're poisoning themselves and that's why he has his 9-day diet and, you know, his directions for so on like that. You have to really think about those things. You can't transcend the body by mistreating it. Master was really clear about that. In Kali Yuga, you could mistreat it and get away with it. It was part of the system. But in Master's path, it's not. So it's an important thing to remember. don't sleep too much. He says, sleep has the tendency to make the will less positive. I thought that was just an interesting comment. To make the will, I don't know what too much is. You just have to sort of, I don't know what too much is. I think too much depends on the person. There's a point at which you're really sleeping, and then there's another point at which you're staying in bed. I think all of us sort of know the difference. My personal rule is if I'm really asleep, I can stay there. But if I'm not really asleep, I have to get up. I can't meditate. I can't meditate without enough sleep. So I can't get up earlier than I can actually. I can't get up out of sleep and meditate. I don't have that much control. So I have to sleep if I'm asleep. But if I'm lying there thinking about whether I'm asleep, I have to get up. Does that make sense? But Swami also has been quite strong about that. Okay, let's see what else. The other points are obvious. He does say, and I think this is something that you just really have to remember, it's very natural to have temptations. He says God does not mind that. He created the delusions himself. He knows what we're up against. And you don't have to be upset, he said. It's not a sign of weakness to be tempted. I think that's a really important principle. You know, we think that if in any way we're not already perfect, that means that somehow we've failed. And that's a mindset that we have, especially in our competitive society among people who are used to excelling. You know, we're number one in the class. We always got the A. We went to the best schools. Whatever it is, we're rising through our work. So we get on the spiritual path. I loved this. This was an article in Yoga Journal in the mid-70s. And the article was called The Dark Side of Meditation. And the dark side of meditation was that type A, highly competitive, overstressed people are the ones who take up meditation. And then they go at meditation with their type A, overstressed, competitive attitude. I saw a cartoon, I think came over Facebook, so some of you may have seen it. And this yogi, it's a yogi cartoon. And the yogi person is saying to the doctor, I want to be the best at relaxation. I want to be on the cutting edge of relaxation. And that's the dark side of it, is that we bring into it this same competitive thought, and we're always measuring ourselves by some utterly hallucinatory standard that we ourselves have created, which is that if we're not already perfect, then we have failed. And it's an extremely important thing. If you're going to take on something as serious as really controlling your life force, whether you're celibate or married or single or whatever situation you're in, but you're wanting to keep your energy relatively refined, you're going to have to work at it. And it's the given that you're going to have to work at it. So several times in here, Swami says it takes 5 to 8 years to change a habit. I mean, that's just the beginning. And you know, this is something that's just very powerful that God has made. And we just have to work with ourselves in a happy way. That's why when I was saying last week, when the young woman asked Swamiji, is sex bad? Oh, don't worry, he said, you'll overcome it. You'll transcend it. Just don't worry about it. And he had just spoken of just how useless it was. And then his next answer is, oh, don't worry about it. Because this is just who we are. And we'll learn by our experience. What was the... it was very interesting to me, though. I've been rereading the autobiography of a yogi, which is a highly recommended practice because it changes every time you read it. There was a line in there, and it was about, remember the disciple Kumar who came to Sri Yukteswar's ashram and was a favorite of Sri Yukteswar, but then left and then came back with a number of unattractive habits that made him unsuitable for the monastic life. And then Master in that chapter has the line, it doesn't take any refinement to enjoy wine and sex. And that's been a very interesting thought in my mind. It's just anybody and everybody, people of absolutely no consciousness, no expanded awareness whatsoever, find pleasure in those things. It's just the way it is. We were when we went on that pilgrimage weekend with Swamiji to Kanyakumari, I wrote a letter when I was in India last year. We went to Kanyakumari at the end of Kanyakumari, that's what it's called, right? Anyway, there were a lot of villagers who were on some kind of a pilgrimage there, and they were pilgrimaging just like we were to this place. But it was so interesting because they were in a spiritual environment, but you could see that their consciousness was not very exalted, and it was sort of in this country, we don't have a caste like that. We don't have villagers in the same way that you have in India. And it was just so interesting to be in their environment. And then you hear about Kumar, who had acquired certain unpleasant habits, and there was an undistinguished villager, you know, undistinguished peasant in front of you. And you can see, because Master wasn't explicit, but his energy had just gone in, his life force had gone in the most obvious directions. And that was an interesting way for me to put it, because we think of ourselves as being refined in so many ways. And it takes more willpower and more energy to enjoy more refined things than that which just comes in so obviously and draws your energy immediately. For some reason, it was a helpful remark for me, because it put things in perspective. You know, this is natural, but we're trying to be supernatural. And so we can't, suppression serves nothing. And he says in here, if people merely control their actions without controlling the underlying understanding and perception that motivates those actions, then you get hypocrisy. And that's what you see all over this country. People, you know, the ones who make the biggest noise against homosexuals are always the ones who are found out for having boyfriends on the side. You know, the ones who make the biggest point about the family, they get divorced and get married and they have affairs. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's just embarrassing because they don't know how to change the real perception. They're just trying to force a behavior. That's why it's better. It's far better. And that's why Swami spoke to the woman that way. It's far better just to be who you are, because it'll take care of itself more easily than if you merely try to paste on without actually shifting your perception. Work on refining your nature, doing Kriya, doing Hong Sa, doing all the other things that Master recommends, your exercise, your diet, your wholesome company. Work on all of that, and then your natural refinement will change your tastes. But if you just try to force a change in taste without actually trying to elevate your consciousness, you just end up at war with yourself. And my personal experience, my observed experience, I have never seen anybody helped by being at war with themselves. At war with yourself. You can be engaged with yourself, but to be really at war with yourself, to have actually divided yourself into two parts, the evil part, and you know, and the part you're trying to aspire to, all you end up is just really, really mixed up. And if you don't straighten it out this lifetime, you straighten it out in the next. And you know, all of us are recovering from past lives. We don't want to have to recover from this one too. We want this one to be one that's just like serviceful all the way through to the end. And so consciousness and attitude, freedom, love of God, knowing God loves you, you know, that's all that matters. You don't want to be on your deathbed and be apologizing. You know, you don't want to be saying you're sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry I didn't do this. I'm so sorry I didn't do that. You want to be at peace. Surprising number of people say I'm sorry at the end of their lives. And that's different than making amends where amends are due, but just kind of a cosmic sense. Swamiji talked about, not in here, but that disciple that he went to see who was on his deathbed saying, oh, I've done so many wrong things. I've done so many wrong things in my life. And Master Swami said was very sad that out of the whole lifetime, his focus was on his failures, when he could just as easily have focused on his successes. It was just there were some of both. So that's why even if we're struggling or failing or whatever we're doing, just keep your mind always on all the positive things you're doing to make your life better. And if they're not working yet, they will. You know, from a perspective of years, that's the one emphatic thing that I know. It really does work. All you have to do is not quit and just keep at it. And every time you fall down and every time you just embarrass yourself and think you really cannot survive this one, just get up and go. And it's fine. And it's forgotten and you forget it and just keep on moving. And time passes and by Jove, there you are. Just amazing. I find it amazing. I love seeing all my gray-haired friends who used to be young. And we're still here. And my young friends who are just starting out, I hope that you get really, really old doing this. Not soon, but eventually. You know what I mean? Exactly. Just a long-distance race. If you're in a really, really long race, you don't expect to finish, you don't expect to reach the finish line the first hour. Think of this as just a really long race. And the most important thing is that you pace yourself in such a way that you can just keep going. If you make it impossible, that's what Swami warned me at one point. He said, you make the spiritual path so narrow, you'll fall off of it. You make yourself so self-critical and you give yourself so few options. Remember last week I was talking about one of my friends just took certain instructions as if they applied to him, and I never even considered it. I mean, the only way I could walk the path was to make it wide enough to include some of my bad habits. If I really, which I started to do for a while, made all of my natural inclinations evil in the sight of God, there was no choice. I was going, it was just too narrow a path. I couldn't hold it. I would have blown out at one point or another. That was when I, as I said, Swami pleaded with me not to do that. Because he could see what I was inclined to do. God just wants you to be happy. Just relax. It's okay. And if you're just not ready to deal with sex, then just don't deal with it. It'll come. You'll transcend it. You have to. And if it's not today, you'll do it later. And don't worry, you'll get to do it. But by the time it comes, it'll be your actual experience. It won't be somebody else telling you that you're going to go to hell. And then it's fine. Then it's just, even if you're still struggling with yourself, you're imposing it on yourself. Okay, he has a really interesting, I'm going on to the next chapter. You know, actually, well, I'll talk about that later, but we're going to finish this book before we run out of time. So I had some ideas for after this. Not tonight, but in the next 5 weeks. Swamiji, this we're going into a completely other subject. Swamiji, of course, is giving this class to a group of monastics who are living together in an ashram. And he goes into a story here, a little bit at the beginning, about how everybody's energy affects everyone else. And he uses first the negative example of how mob violence takes place and how the reason and feeling have to always be kept into balance. And when too much emotion begins to run, then people get swept into realities that they don't really want to be swept up into. They go a little crazy. And there's lots of examples, too many examples, in recent history even, of whole countries just completely going insane. With the partition of India between the Muslims and the Hindus, the genocide in Rwanda, the Jews and the Nazis, and we have so many examples of where otherwise good people who in a normal state of mind could never imagine behaving that way suddenly get swept up into this actual force. And this force begins to move through them and they are influenced by the energy around them. And then Swamiji gives us the exact opposite example, which is the experience that we have when we're in the company of a saintly person. And he talks about being in the company of Master because Master was still there when he was giving these classes, just how extraordinarily powerful we can also get swept up into the positive energy. And just what a shift in consciousness happens. I remember once sitting in here when we were listening to Swami, and I was concentrating particularly hard, and this was an interesting technique which I recommend. I was actually concentrating word by word. You know, normally when one listens, you anticipate what's coming and you kind of hear the whole thought as it comes out. And I was just practicing not trying to be as much in the now as I could possibly be and actually listen word by word. Because when Swamiji or someone of his spiritual stature is speaking, And I remember explaining to you once, I felt once when he was talking, particularly that particular talk, that he was just putting out a spiritual vibration, and then after it was even outside of his body, he would put a word on it. And that he was actually giving us vibrations, and then he had to put words on them because we needed that. But that the words were the last part of what he was offering. So with that thought in mind, I was just trying to receive vibration by vibration as he spoke. And it was just so interesting to attune, is really what it was, because to be that concentrated. You don't have a lot else going on in your mind. And just feel the effect of elevated consciousness. Now, that's a very good argument for darshan, and a very good argument for taking the opportunities, which are not many these days, but to be wherever Swamiji is when we do have a chance to be with him. One moment in the company of a saint, they say, is there a raft over the ocean of delusion, so we take it. It's not automatic. In a recent Sunday reading, there was the story about Jesus and the woman who touched the hem of his garment, and she was healed, and he felt her touch the hem of his garment, and he said, "Who touched me?" And the disciples were so bewildered because many, many people were touching him. They were all crowding around, reaching out and touching him, but he felt one person touch him because she touched him with attunement, and the consciousness was transferred. She was receptive, and the consciousness was transferred. He was not different. But she was different than most of those who were touching, and so she was able to pull it out from him, and she instantly received a healing because she approached him from a wholly, wholly different spot. But the other side that Swami's emphasizing here, which is really what is the more important side of this, the nature of God is giving. I mean, that the divine flow is outwardly flowing. If you knew how much God loved you, you would die for joy. If the divine took his consciousness away from us for a split second, all of creation would stop. The nature of joy is to want to share itself. There's all these different ways of saying it. Greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death, for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. I mean, when you stop and think about it, Swami writes about this beautifully in The Path, about the master's compassion, and that nothing drew him back. Nothing compels him to take a body except the desire to help others. Now, that's the lines in the Festival of Light, and the next line is, here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey through time and space, the redemption to those who offer up their little light into the infinite light of God. Okay, what's saying there is, we have to mimic, we have to become, we have to reach the same state of consciousness that the masters have. That's what we all say we're going to do. And that is a state entirely of giving. That there's no, and it's not, it's just like we were talking about life control, it's not just controlling your behavior, it's simply the way you perceive reality. Swami tells the amazing story of being with Ananda Moyi Ma and saying to her, "Oh, how generous you are with your time," or "how unselfish you are with your time." And she looked at him and said, "Oh, is that how it looks to you?" Meaning, you know, who is there to be selfless or selfless? It's just, as Sister Gyanamata said, it's the nature of a fig tree to give figs. There's nothing special about the tree, it's what it does. Now, we live in various states of self-concern, and the masters have simply, there's no self to be concerned about. "I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God." So Swamiji is reminding us on this very, very subtle level that when we live close together, and not all of you live in the community, but we live very close together because we come together in this exceedingly refined way. You know, we're not just coming together and laughing and joking and drinking beer together. And, you know, we were in Carmel and, you know, we were in one restaurant. We sort of accidentally went into this place because Swami was really tired and it was really close. Things had spun a little bit out of our management. And he was tired and we went into this place. And we actually ordered dinner, but it was just awful. We just couldn't stand. There was absolute chaos. Everybody was screaming and it was terrible. And there was a lot of drinking. And they were just like kind of screaming. You know, just screaming, because when you get a little inebriated, you get hard of hearing. That's what Dr. Peter said. When you're a little drunk, your hearing is affected, and that's why drunk people make a lot of noise. Because they don't know that they're making noise and they can't hear each other when they make noise, and then it accelerates. But, you know, we couldn't. We just couldn't stay there. But sometimes in restaurants there would be, in last 1 week when we were there, there'd be a lot of hilarity over at some table. Oh, they must have a lot of wine. Because you could just feel it accelerating. Well, you know, that kind of company is not good company. It doesn't leave you in a very good place. The way we come together, Sunday services, meditations, even our social events, there's a refinement to it. Anybody can enjoy sex and wine, but you know, we're more refined than that. I remember, I've told you all, when I was working on the incorporation of Ananda Village into trying to make it a California city in 1980 and 81, one of the local people that we hired to do some studies and was also one of the politicians who was going to make the decision had an annual Christmas party, and he included us at his Christmas party, myself and my partner in that, this woman named Dallas Atkins. And we went to the Christmas party because we were trying to schmooze with the greater Nevada County at that point. And we walked into this party, and it took me a little while to realize, and I've said this to you all before, there was absolutely nothing was going to happen in this party. It was lasting a few hours. There was a piano, but it was turned to the wall. And it just became obvious to me after a little while that we were just going to drink. And that was all we were going to do. We weren't going to sing Christmas carols. We weren't going to play games. We weren't going to do anything. We were just going to drink. I mean, we weren't going to drink, but they were going to drink. And we stayed there for a little while, and they all began to drink. And then they all began to talk loud and think they were having an experience. And we, of course, gracefully exited at that point. But it was like, I felt so heartsick because there was nothing to bring everybody's consciousness up. And the way we're together, we bring everybody's consciousness up. Even if it's just a social event, we always orchestrate it in such a way that we become unified with each other because we're elevating our energy together, which makes us very, very receptive to each other's energy, even if we don't want to be. I mean, if we're not trying to be, is what I mean to say. There's a joke at Ananda, which is you can never be the first person to tell anyone news. My belief is that there is one nerve wire, and if anybody hears the news, somehow everybody knows it. There's no logic to that, but if you're ever the first one to pass along some news, it's a really exceptional event. Because we just sort of all know things at the same time. A certain amount of it is intuition, a certain amount of it is we just have so many friends and everybody talks. So there's nothing mystical about it. But it's my private joke. But there is a certain truth to that, that we just know each other. And the radiations of our individual consciousness have a very profound effect on each other. And this works very much to our advantage in the sense that whenever somebody's having a downtime, everybody else's positive energy can help. And it also, and this is the part that Swami's talking about that I think we have to consider, we serve each other as friends by doing our best to keep our consciousness elevated, even when we're alone, but especially when we're together. Swamiji has often commented, Leela, the woman who's been his cook for many, many years, he commented to me once, you know, she always smiles, she's always cheerful, and whatever she has to go through in her own personal life, and she's had to go through some serious things, her husband died suddenly and things like that, but and you watch her, whenever she comes into Swami, she just puts out a sweet smile and a positive attitude, because she feels that she owes him that. You know, she owes him her best energy, and she's always going to give it to him. And she wants to. It's not like she's being insincere or out of touch with herself or anything like that, but that's what she wants to give him. But it's a deliberate decision on her part. But why would we not be that way with everybody? When I first started at Ananda Village and I was put into the kitchen at the seclusion retreat, And there was a period of time when I was cooking there all the meals, including Sunday lunch, and Swami Kriyananda gave Sunday service every other Sunday. And on the Sunday he wasn't giving it, he didn't come to the retreat. He didn't come to other people's services. And the Sunday he gave service, he would stay and have lunch. On the Sundays that he was there, I was a terrible cook, but I did my best. I did my best to make a very nice meal. Gradually I learned to actually make a nice meal, but I did my best. On the Sundays that he wasn't there, I just put out whatever I felt like putting out. I mean, it was so dramatic. And then one day I realized, I don't think this is pleasing to Swamiji. I don't think it pleases him to know that I'm willing to put out energy for him, but just who cares about anybody else? You know, that's how the ego wants to be treated. You know, I want somebody to love me, me, and just me, and always do special things for me, me, and just me. But the refined soul rejoices when it sees a selfless attitude, not when it sees giving toward itself. Although Swamiji said something interesting once, there was someone who was very difficult to get along with, but was always harmonious with Swamiji. And Swamiji's answer was, well, and it was a woman, if she can be that way with me, I know she has it in her to be that way with everyone. And I certainly know that that's what I learned. Because I thought for a while, I'm so willing to put out all that energy for him, why would I not put it out for everyone? And I began to feel bad because I enjoyed putting out that much energy, and I suddenly realized that my attitude toward everyone else was God less present in them. It was so selfish. It's like I get from Swami, so I'll give to Swami. I was just a Vaishya. I was just being a merchant. He gives to me, so I give to him, and you guys, well, you're just hanging out, so you can eat anything. But I wasn't taking responsibility for being part of a spiritual community. And that's just an extremely important aspect of being part of a spiritual community. You're not in it just for what you get. You're in it because together we make things happen. And I've written at different times when I was in the early years of Ananda Village, it was very good training in a very real sense. One, we were very isolated. There was no place to go and no way to get there. And everybody always knew where everybody was. Just because where could you be, right? And as a consequence, you had to participate in everything because it was just like, where are you if you're not there? So very early, and the other reason you had to participate is that if everybody didn't show up, there was no it there. There was no there there, you know? The Sunday service could not happen without everybody coming because everybody was 50 people. And if 10 of them stayed away, I mean, it was a huge percentage. So we all got into the thought that we're not asking, oh, do I feel inspired? We're saying it's happening, we go. Because if we go and give our best energy to it, then it happens. That there's no them in this situation. And there's no them even in Swami Kriyananda doing it. It's all of us together. And Swamiji encourages, you know, the monks in this ashram to really realize that the emanations of our own consciousness are defining the environment that we live in, and that we can positively, generously help our brothers and sisters. Durga had a beautiful dream once in which she dreamt that there was a whole big circle of Ananda brothers and sisters. And she, you know, it wasn't so much who was there. She recognized some, but mostly she knew everybody in the circle was part of one of her guru bhais, one of her brothers and sisters. And she said, we were all holding hands. And every so often, it would sort of be understood that it was time for someone to ascend. And then that person, whoever it was, they would turn into light, and then they would just sort of rise and vaporize and just go up and merge into the light. And then, you know, the circle would close and we would all... But she said what was so interesting was that there was no sense of, oh, I wish it were me. She said, when anybody expanded and expanded spiritually and went into the light, everybody rejoiced. And it was such a beautiful realization that there was no other. It was just us. And that is not an accident. That's a deliberate, actual decision. I was having a conversation recently in our community with, you know, we're essentially running three parallel communities right now. We have total outsiders who rent apartments, who are just congenial people who come and go. We have a group of people who really like community. And a lot of them came in through our school, and they really like community. They love having their children there. They love the community. But they don't participate in this temple. And then we have the people who participate in the temple. And the people who participate in the temple, I believe, are the ones who are creating the atmosphere that everybody is enjoying. Because what makes it a community is that we worship God together. We're dedicated to doing a work for Master. And we're not really there for ourselves. We're there for what we can make happen and what we can give. A side effect of that is that it creates a nice atmosphere for people who want to live as they want to live. But that's a side effect of what the people who participate in the temple are doing. And it's the way things are right now, and you know, we'll work with it. But the Ananda community is the devotion to Master, the devotion to Master's work, and the worshiping God together and the serving of the divine mission together. And that's where the power is. You know, things in this world look certain ways, but they're not always what they seem. Speaking of cooking, when I was cooking in that kitchen and had come from the background of being a food fanatic, and just didn't, I actually, Swami, actually, this is what he said, you were so mental you didn't know what things tasted like. Which I thought was, wow, that's quite a statement. But I actually still know what he means, because often I'm so lost in my thoughts I don't notice. Now I can notice, but sometimes I don't notice. Then I couldn't notice. That's what he said. But I couldn't even make food taste good when I wanted it to taste good. I just didn't know how. I'd follow the recipe and it would just come out so badly. I just didn't have the knack. And I was utterly bewildered. First I didn't care, then I cared and couldn't make it happen. When Swamiji saw that I had advanced from not caring to wanting to make it happen, and he'd also received a lot of complaints. Because everybody at the meditation retreat had to eat what I cooked. I was practically the only cook. Nobody had kitchens. They all had to eat there. And I served them kale and Jerusalem artichokes every day. I mean, like, even the thought of it. Actually, people disliked Jerusalem artichokes so much that we went from having bumper crops of Jerusalem artichokes to the same soil and the same plants hardly producing. Shivani said it's because we just bad vibed the devas so much. They were doing such good work for us, and we just didn't like their results, and they just said, well, then to heck with you, and they just stopped growing Jerusalem artichoke. Thank God. But anyway, I didn't even think, you know, that wasn't something that people would love. I ate them every day. I was, you know, they were so good for you. They were healthy. They were from the garden. But there was a revolt, a very serious revolt. So he's coming to me and just kind of feeling out my energy at this point, trying to find out where I'm at, and He does it step by step. My, he said, that dish that you made for the potluck was a little bit bland. I said, yes, sir, it did. It came out very bland. He said. I wanted it to be good, but it didn't come out right. He said. And he just saw that I was wanting to learn now instead of just self-righteously not. He said, well, I guess I'll have to teach you to cook. And that weekend, this Swami came, who was a big man, tall and wide. He had a great affection for food. And he was an old friend of Swamiji's from India. And he was there from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. He was staying up, and Satya was his host, and Satya would bring him down to Swami's house. And most all day, every day of those 3 days, I was at Swamiji's house with Satya and this Swami and Swami Kriyananda and Seva. And I don't remember much about what we were doing, but they were talking about India and Anandamayi Ma. I think they'd met at Ma's ashram and like this. And Swami cooked for him at least lunch and dinner, maybe breakfast, lunch and dinner. And he had me help him. And when he was going to start cooking, the first time I showed up, you know, he's going to teach me to cook. So I had a notebook and a pencil like this. And he starts, you know, throwing things in the pot and, oh, that's a little too much of that. Well, we'll just add some of this. You know, it wasn't as bad as that woman trying to clean up after Master, but it was real close to it. You know, I'm trying to scribble down all these things thinking I'm going to walk away with recipes, and he's just doing one thing after another. Finally, I had the sense. I just put my notebook down and I just assisted him. You know, I cut onions, I handed him things, and I washed dishes. And he really cooked. He was a very good cook, and he did all the cooking. And the very last evening, we were trying to decide what to have to eat because it was a very important discussion with the Swami, and we decided that we would have a fruit salad. And Seva said, oh, Swamiji, I'll just go up and make it. And he said, oh, that would be nice. You and Asha can make it. And then he said, no, just very emphatically, I'm teaching Asha to cook, he said like that. And then he walked up and we cut fruit together and put it in the bowl. Monday morning, I knew how to cook. I have no idea. I just knew how to do it from that moment, and I'm considered to be quite a good cook, and I'm really quite impressed. I am. I just knew how to do it. There was some, why on earth am I telling that story? There was some emanation from his consciousness that just came into my consciousness. He understood how food is assembled and what it's supposed to taste like and how to balance it, and I just got it. I just picked it up at that point. It was just amazing to me. It was also an interesting lesson. This is totally unrelated because I don't even remember why I went here, but cooking was like so unimportant to me. I had been raised in a very intellectual family, and the only thing that was of real value was intellectually oriented things. And cooking just didn't fit anywhere in that. So as a consequence, I didn't have any anxiety about being a good cook. I had a tremendous anxiety for much of my life about writing because that was sort of something of value, and so I had to worry about it. But cooking was like so, like who cares, that in a sense I was able to just accept intuitive training and learn how to use my intuition in cooking. Because it was just a game to me. I didn't have anything involved in it. I didn't realize how much they were suffering, all those people, until later. But I just, and then it just sort of came to me. And many, many times through then, I've referred inside myself to that experience to try to, when my ego is much more invested, to try to find the place where it's just a game. What difference does it make? You know, just allow yourself to be taught and just let your energy flow. Now let me see if I can even try to think for a minute. I think I can't not possibly tie it into anything, although I had a reason for starting. That was it. It was cooking well for everyone. There you have it. Thank you, Nishkama. So on that note, we'll take a break. How did people react when they got my new meals? They had been gracious up until that, so there was no... It was only slowly that I found out how seriously upset they were. I think I was just too oblivious. And everybody was nice. And I was nice. I cooked for people. I loved them all and they all loved me. But kale and artichokes were doing them in. Yeah. Jerusalem artichokes. Yeah. The reason I can't pick it out is because my whole life during those few years was just such a confused mess. It would be impossible to pick out any little piece of it. It was a trajectory that I can look back over, but so much of it was the whole entity was moving up, but the entity itself was spinning in wild gyrations of confusion continuously while the whole thing was going forward. And it was a long process before that internal chaos began to subside sufficiently that I could see anything clearly. One of the things he talks about is clear reasoning. I didn't have a lot of it. My very good karma, which I thank God for every day. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Would have been so easy for Swami to have hurt my feelings. And then once my feelings got hurt, it would have been so hard for me to go forward. He always knew that he would never, if my feelings got hurt, I couldn't hear anything else. So even in the whole question, even with the, you know, in-house rebellion against my cooking, he wouldn't have done anything if I hadn't expressed really sincere desire to be different. And it was a three-part cycle of him making a light comment, my agreeing with him, then him making a slightly more comment, my agreeing with him again. You know, it was like three parts before he really said, okay, I'll teach you to cook. But he wouldn't have said that. I know for a fact he wouldn't have said it if anywhere along the line I said something like, well, I thought it was pretty good. If he'd said, I thought it was bland, because it would have been a natural thing for a person to say, well, I thought it was good. A lot, and here's what other people say. A lot of people liked it. That's what you usually say. When you're criticized, you tell the person who's criticizing you that nobody agrees with him. I mean, it's classic. When you hear yourself do it, close your mouth. Because everybody who wants to defend themselves defends themselves by telling you that nobody agrees with you. But you have to listen. It was bland, and I knew it. Oh, he said, okay, you're paying attention. And I don't want it to be. Ah, okay, then maybe we can help you. Absolutely, all those things were true. But he waited. They were pretty tortured for a while before he brought it up. Okay, let's now take a short break, very short. After Swamiji's visit, which is like he leaves on the 17th of September, Tuesday night is the 18th, and I'm going to do the Mahabharata. We have 11 weeks from the time he leaves to the beginning of December, and I think I'm going to do like 6 weeks on the Mahabharata and 5 weeks the Ramayana. I'm just going to tell both stories, and we'll video it. And that's going to be lots of fun. And with an expert like Sai Ganesh in here, it's going to be really fun. Okay? Yeah. Anyway, so, and we're going to make a video of it. So we have more classes than I have room for here. So I actually thought I might open up the biography to the Hinduism Christianity chapter, which you had suggested, and do 3 or 4 classes. I'm not quite sure how many I have left, but I haven't finished these pages tonight, so I'll finish these pages next week. We'll finish this book next week. And then the week after that, we'll go to the Hinduism and Christianity, just for fun, because it was a very good idea. I have intermittent classes, but there's 5, I believe, counting this one, there's 5 that I'll be here. And there's not more 5 more classes in this. I'm just sort of telling you. I'll have Dambara announce it. Okay. From the new biography, there's a chapter called Hinduism and Christianity, which Marilyn thought and pointed out would be a very good discussion. So I just pull that one chapter out and do that. It's apropos of nothing in particular except itself. It's just a random insertion because I need to keep off the streets because idleness does not serve me. Okay. So if I'd really thought about that seriously, I would have made sure I finished tonight, but I'm not going to. So are there any comments or questions about anything that we've said so far? What Sarah's saying is that patience and endurance is the key here. What this chapter is about is how to deal with temptation and tests. And Sarah was saying that the summary of everything I've said is patience and endurance. Remember we talked about titiksha earlier? Now let's go back even farther. The essential attitudes of the devotee, one of them is courage, right at the very, very beginning. The courage, positive thinking, even-minded and cheerful, serving the divine in all, God alone. Those were the 5 essential attitudes we started with. And patience and endurance is really primarily courage. People don't tend to think of it as courage. Yeah, you have to just have, you hear the phrase all the time, you just have to have the courage to endure. You have the courage to persevere. People quit. You know, and what is it that makes you quit? Well, you don't have the courage to persevere. Usually speaking, courage is not what you might be thinking, but it's usually courage that's lacking. The courage to risk, the courage to suffer, to risk suffering, the courage to endure. I mean, endurance implies that you're not having a whole lot of fun. I joke a lot that I don't have a lot of endurance, although in fact I do. But I've thought of myself as not having a lot of endurance, but I have a lot of creativity because I don't endure very well. So as soon as I find it intolerable, I create an alternative. But that's actually a way of solving problems also, which is that this is really not working for me, but I'm not going to go backwards. I'm going to go forward. I'm just going to find another way to go forward. So there's many ways to endure. You don't have to, in fact, positive thinking at all times is a really and attunement to the creative process. I asked Swamiji once, what is the secret of prosperity? He gave a one-word answer, creativity. Remember? Which is, if this isn't working, I'll try something else. And if that doesn't work, I'll try this. And if that doesn't work, I'll try that. And if you just keep trying something new with intelligence and intuition, not just kind of randomly, but if you do, and sometimes even if you just do it randomly, God will take mercy on you. But you have to be applying yourself completely. Then it will work out. You just don't give up. And eventually you create prosperity of one sort or another, and if not in this lifetime, in the next. But you see how much courage is required to do that? That's why the very first essential attitude of a devotee is courage. Most people who give up on the spiritual path chicken out. It's the only way you can put it. It's just too much. I'm fighting my desires all the time. I don't get along with this person. You know, sometimes people leave Ananda because they have a bad manager. Somebody, you know, whose decisions they don't agree with, and they get treated badly. I mean, this happens. And you know, somebody left over such a situation. They were treated badly. There's no question about it. Bad decisions were made in regard to them. Person left. And I was talking to someone else, and the person I was talking to was trying to justify that decision. I just looked at her and I said, you've been treated badly many times. Have you ever thought of leaving? No. You know, okay, I have a bad manager right now. Bad in the sense of inexperienced and not yet capable of doing a good job. And I'm fodder. You know, everybody's karma plays into itself. You have to have the courage. You have to have the courage to let other people learn their lessons. You have to have the courage to believe that you belong to this family, even if today it's not working so well. And it's not so easy. You have to have the courage to believe that it will work out. You have to have the courage to have faith in the happy ending, both for yourself and for the whole story. And that all comes back to what I was saying earlier about we're in this together. The emanations of your consciousness affect everybody else. And having that, I've said it before, but it's really interesting to me. Everything comes down to the patient application of willpower. And you just, whenever a problem seems insoluble, that mantra has really helped me. This just seems overwhelming. But I know by the patient application of willpower, I will get to the end of this. And you know, this is how lessons are learned. I learned that a lot, really got that strongly from doing costumes for the school play. Another one of those things that are like it's just not like a really big important part of the persona that I put out to the world is that I do costumes for the school play. But it's just an impossibly huge project. And when I first begin, it's just chaos beyond chaos. I've done it about 4 times now. But this year when I went into it, it's just like, oh, I know this. The patient application of willpower, that's all I have to do. I just have to not quit. We just have to do it step by step by step by step. And that's been enormously helpful in areas of huge importance to me, where I'm facing exactly the same feeling and it's the same solution. Just have the courage and the faith in God to just the patient application of willpower. And if we all have that collectively, you see, we all, to go back to where I was earlier, we don't just believe in ourselves, but we believe in each other. And even in a paradoxical way, I have been saved by the community, you know, in very serious ways, because I lost faith in myself, but other people did not lose faith in me. And that was a critical thing when I was writing the book about Swami, when I just really completely lost faith that I could ever do that. And I woke up one morning and realized that I was in a community of extremely intelligent, sensitive, perceptive people, and they all thought I could do it. I was the only one who thought I couldn't. Even Swami Kriyananda thought I could do it. And I thought, chances are, I'm the one who's wrong. And it really just, that was the turning point for me. I thought, I just keep insisting on this point of view, but what are the chances that all these people are wrong and I'm right? And I said, not very good. And I just somehow, the whole, you know, self-centered delusion began to crack. It didn't all, the edifice didn't collapse in a day, but it cracked. And so we're all in it together. and we just have faith in each other, you'll find, if you haven't already found, that's often when you are absolutely feeling the worst, like you're struggling to keep your head above water, people will say, wow, you look wonderful. And it's happened enough that in a way it's true. Because sometimes when you're just having to exert all your will just to hold on to the edge of the cliff and not, you know, fall over, you do look really well. Because you're really one-pointed. You don't have any margin to just mess around. Everything has to be right there because this is the last, and it's a joke. You look so good. Well, I don't feel good. I feel horrible. Then you also begin to think, I've had these, it got to be a joke between Swamiji and me. He would say, how are you? I don't know, sir. How am I? Because how do I know how I am? And on one occasion he said, I'm worried about you. Me too. You know, it's like, because I was so confused, I didn't know what to do. And you know, then sometimes he would say, you're okay. I said, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. But it really, for a long time, I don't know, how am I? How would I know? And I mean, I had particular faith in him, but really, you can have faith, you can have a lot of faith in a lot of people. If you look to the community to be the voice of the guru to you, it will be. And people even who in themselves do not have an independent wisdom will yet be the instrument for you. And it's a very important part of it. I'm passionate about this because it's the hardest thing to sell, because there's such an emphasis on self-realization that people don't get where the community fits in. They want to live there, they want to raise their kids there, all that sort of thing, but they don't get what the real thing is, that it's this unifying of our consciousness on a refined level for a higher purpose. And it will save you. That's your environment, that's your satsang, and it will save you. And so I know what I really wanted to say about this. So it's a critical moment when you're in trouble, whether you turn toward the community or away from it. And if people disappear and, I was having such a hard time, you know, I just didn't want to come. My gosh, that's the point at which you just need to glue yourself to this chair. Bring your sleeping bag. Don't ever leave the temple. You know, it's like, who cares? That's the time, that's payback time for you. That's when everybody else carries you. And you have to let them. You know, sometimes people, I emphasize giving, but giving is also allowing people into your life and allowing them to carry you when you can't carry them. You can't always be the strong one. It's just, you're just not able. He acknowledged you needed help. This, Ramani just told a story, if it wasn't recorded, about when she was in India and she had an operation and there were complications, so she was unwell for quite some time, and how every time Swami talked to her, he would say, oh, Ramani, you're so well. And finally, Ramani said that she said to Swamiji, how much you've helped me. And it was just the accepting of the help that you were talking about. Yeah. Yeah, like she finally, he was saying it to you over and over. And, you know, I've had experiences like with that. I'm trying to remember exactly the context where Swami would try to give somebody something, not a physical thing, but give them something, and they would not take it. You know, I wish I could ground that in an example. I can't right at the moment. I'll have to try to recall. But he would try to give somebody something and then they just wouldn't take it from him. You know, give them an affirmation and they would reject it. Give them a positive point of view and they would reject it. And it would just, you just sort of watch. You know, he's trying to give you something, but you're not going to take it. Out of humility or out of a kind of strange, distorted humility. Oh, well, you just did that so well. Oh, no, I didn't, sir. It really wasn't so good. Or, you know, it looks like things are going really well for you. Well, not really, sir. They're really having a problem. You know, just like where he would offer and you don't take it. A lot of times, and people do that. People, you get in the habit of not taking what's offered you. These are all things you have to really start watching in community. Somebody says to you, Swamiji especially, you're well. Yes, sir, I'm feeling much better. And you have to be honest. Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, whatever is the truth, you have to be sincere. You might not be feeling well, but I'm so glad to hear you say that, sir. That's so encouraging to hear you say it. Thank you for telling me that, but you have to take it. That's the woman who took the corner of the robe and was healed because she knew she just had to grab that robe. And not only did she know he had the power, she was willing to take it. She was willing to let him heal her. It's odd how often we reject the blessings of God when they come to us. And they often come to us just in somebody else's positive thought, and we just won't take it. Whenever you hear yourself repudiating a positive offer, you know, then close your mouth. Just close your mouth, right? Just in the middle of a sentence, close your mouth. If people are giving you something positive, just take it. Be happy to have it. Why not? You know, we get really confused between facts and truth. You know, truth is the positive flow of energy. The positive flow is the truth. The facts might not be in accord with that, but if we take the truth, then the facts will come into accord with it. If we reject the truth, then the facts will just hang out there, and they'll always be that way. That was what I learned at great cost in the course of the 3 months of the Bertolucci lawsuit over here. Every single day, Swami would get up and say, I think it's going to go our way this day. And every single day, all of us would say, no, I don't think so. We were all in the same room. He knew more than we did about what was going on, but we were so fixed, and I don't want to condemn my brothers and sisters. I'll just speak about myself. He would, you know, I think, you've heard me say this, I think juror number 3 is really looking sympathetic. No, 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 no. And he knew what the facts were. He was trying to, you know, get us into, he was just trying to teach us something. And it was very subtle because we couldn't be airheads about it. It was too practical and grounded a situation. But he was just trying to teach us a little bit about positive magnetism. But we were so caught on the facts. Very tricky. Once, you know, he used to say, this year at Spiritual New Week, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s, this year at Spiritual New Week, we're going to have 250 people. And we'd have 30, 40. And he would say that, and everyone would say, yeah, sure. And then once he said to me, I know how many people we're going to have, but if I didn't say 250, we wouldn't even have 30. You know, it's just like he understood magnetism. He understood how things happen in this world. And we were so just caught on the material plane that when he would say 250, we'd have to correct him immediately. It's just like, how many years does it take? It takes a lot of years. And I watched him work from magnetism, which is so much of a higher truth than facts. And then I watched all of us fight with the facts for so long. There was 1 year, this to me is very poignant. I tried to write this up from the book on Swami, and I couldn't. I'll have to write it again another time. It was in the mid-80s somewhere, when Ananda was really, or early 80s, mid-early 80s, we were really on a roll. And we had what was called the Yoga Fellowship. We had a meeting. And this is my interpretation of it. And I have to be fair to my brothers and sisters. This is my interpretation. He came and he said, now is the time to build a temple. And we had a beautiful design for a temple at that time. Now is the time to build the temple. Let's build a temple. And he was declaring a lot of things, and we were just riding on his magnetism and doing them. Let's build a temple. So we sort of spent a lot of the morning talking about how we were going to build this temple, how we were going to raise the money. We were poor as church mice. You know, there was no, you know, factual grounds for building the temple, but we were going to build the temple. Then over lunch, a number of people got real down with him. We owe this, we owe this, we have this project, we have this project, this project. So he came back after lunch, and he said, you know, some people, and he was being very respectful. You know, so-and-so says this, and this is a mitigating factor, we have this problem, we have that. What do you all think? Reading over those notes later, I didn't catch it at the time, but reading over those notes later, it was so obvious to me. He wanted us to say, we can do it. And instead we said, yeah, I don't think we can. And he just, I mean, I was taking, you know, notes. He said, oh. We still don't have a temple at the village. But it was sort of like, He wanted us to grab the energy, but instead we just took those discouraging words and we amplified them. And when he saw that we'd amplified them, there was nothing he could do. At that point, there was nothing he could do. I mean, and there's so many examples of that having happened that just chills me. Yeah, we were all in a big circle. Everybody was enthusiastic. And then one said, oh, well, I'm a little afraid about this. And the other one said, well, I'm really afraid about this. And then the third person said, and I am too. And I said, lunch. And when we came back, we changed the format. Because the energy was, we were building so much magnetism, and it just went bump, 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 bump. And then we just didn't allow open mic after that. Yeah, we got a community. But I'd learned by that point, I mean, something about the we're building magnetism, and it was going to work. And then it's very easy to take magnetism down. I've seen Swamiji in many satsangs not let people talk. And he gets so criticized. But he just watches them destroy the energy, or he watches them ruin their own energy. He'll just cut them off so rudely. And then people will write notes, you were so rude, he was so rude. But if you're watching, you can tell what's really happening. He's protecting the magnetism. He's building the magnetism. Well, I think that's fun. Okay? So next week we'll finish the rest of the pages. And then the week after that, whether it's sequential weeks or not, I don't really remember. Whatever the cycle of whatever it is, we'll go into the biography, thanks to Marilyn's good suggestion. Okay, fun. We're going to actually finish this, just like we once finished the Essence of the Gita. And the Material Success Course. I've enjoyed everything. But yes, I learned my lesson with the Gita. But we would still be on the Gita if I hadn't done what I did. I was actually talking about it partially this week. I think it's how to deal with tests and temptations. Overcoming tests and temptations. Yeah, I have this many pages. I've got this many pages. And there was some pretty nifty stuff in here. And besides that, you see how I can just go off.